Growing up in the segregated South, Melba Aiko wasn't aware of the inequality until, at age 9, she visited a white girl's home.
So it was almost like if you've only ever had grape Kool-Aid, you never know that there's other flavors like strawberry that may taste better. Suddenly, those blinders are just completely torn.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today on Sound Effect, the kids are all right. We'll meet a cancer doc who got pulled out of his comfort zone.
And they said, we want you to come over to the maternal fetal medicine unit. And I said, neither maternals or fetals really fall into my remit.
Plus, what if your sex ed class was taught by your dad?
Oh yeah, and you all know my daughter, Ginny, who you go to school with. Mortifying.
That's all ahead on Sound Effect from KNKX, stories inspired by the place we live.
I'm that nappy hair, Gullah Geechee Creole chick from the north end of New Orleans, straight up country.
This is Melba Aiko, founder of Northwest Tap Connection on Rainier Avenue in South Seattle.
From the time that I was born until I would do third grade, I lived in segregated Louisiana, and you know, really seeing white people just from a distance.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and yes, there is a class full of kids learning how to do time steps and heel stands, but Melba says she uses tap dancing as a way to pull kids in. She gets their attention and then tries to teach them how to be socially conscious people. This is where tap dancing meets social justice.
It's really about closing the gap for children of color and underserved communities and giving them an opportunity to have accessibility to the arts.
So how much of the time a kid might spend here would be spent dancing, and how much of it would be spent talking or doing other kinds of stuff?
It depends on who you're asking. If you ask the children, they probably would say that 99% of the time it's Miss Melba talking. If you ask me, that's not quite fair. Whenever you're dealing with children, you're always going to get into life stories, okay? They're usually here for 2 hours, hanging around and talking and listening to conversation. So conversation in the lobby could talk about anything from the fact of, gee, Miss Melba, are you gonna buy, you know, Girl Scout cookies? And sure, I like Girl Scout cookies. Well, were you a Girl Scout? Well, no, I wasn't a Girl Scout. Well, why wasn't you a Girl Scout? Well, because I wanted to be a Brownie, but Brownies had to march in the parade at the very back because we were colored people, and the horses used to have all of their dump. And then we come behind them, so I wasn't a Brownie. So then that opens up dialogues about why, and what can we do differently about it?
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is the kids are all right. We'll hear stories where the worst doesn't happen and meet a few of the people looking out for those kids. One of those people is Melba Aiko. She started tap dancing when she was 7, but when she started to see how tap was associated with blacks entertaining white people, she quit.
You know, when we watched Shirley Temple, you saw the black man dancing, Bill Bojangles Robinson, but he was a butler.
Now you just watch.
He was the, you know, he was the help.
I went to the market for to get some beef. And the beef's
over. But then tap re-entered her life when her daughter's elementary school teacher started using tap dance to teach her students math. As Melba said, she created Northwest Tap Connection to teach the mostly African-American students about their history and ways to make their future better. One of the ways she does this is by sharing stories from growing up in the segregated South in the 60s and 70s. It was during this time that Melba started to notice the effects of racism. She went from being a happy child to an angry one.
I mean, I still, you know, remember the first time I went into a white person's house and I came home and told my mother, why didn't she tell me that we were poor? Because up until that time, you know, what I knew I was happy with. So it was almost like if you've only ever had grape Kool-Aid, you never know that there's other flavors like strawberry that may taste better. Suddenly, at 9 years of age, those blinders of what I had lived secured in segregation are just completely torn.
Do you remember some of the details of that time when you went to your classmate's house?
Yeah, I do. I think we were picking up something. I had to pick up something from school. And so I got to walk into her living room. And I was just in shock because her living room definitely did not look like my living room. And I thought to myself, wow, people actually live like this? It was an incredible journey, but it was a journey that was really a lot of times with a lot of bruises and the feeling of not being able to really talk about how you felt because of the respect that you had for your parents, because it was just, that's what came with living black. That's what came with being born black.
Part of Melba's journey was that first bus ride to her newly desegregated school. It's something she will never forget. And a heads up, this story contains one mention of the N-word.
My mother, I can remember her asking me, how did I feel about going to school on the bus without her for the first day of integration? And you know, I looked at integration still through the eyes I had just turned 9 years old, that I wasn't scared of no white people, you know, because I had been very protective and didn't even know what white people was really all about. So I got on the bus, and Mr. Nolan was the bus driver, and we pulled up to the Lyon Elementary School, and they had all of these white people there, and they had signs with the N-words written all over it and screaming about us to go home, go home, go home. And that was the first time I really started to get afraid, because I was thinking, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, what's gonna happen? And then they started throwing bricks at the bus. And I heard the first shatter of the glass. And I remember Mr. Nolan saying, get underneath the seats, as we crawled underneath the seats so that when glass came through, you wouldn't get covered. And then there was Mr. Jackson was the principal and a white man. And I remember them started screaming that they should torch the bus. They were going to torch the bus. And then Mr. Jackson came on, and he talked about that these are children on the bus and that he wasn't getting off, so that they needed to know that if the bus was torched, that they would be burning a white man too. And, you know, I think about it, that I was so fearful on that day that I thought I would never see my parents, because I just knew that this was going to be it. I was 9 years old. And for elementary school, fourth grade was the highest grade there. But there were children on that bus that would have been like 5 or 6. I thought back to that day and the trauma that I felt on that day, you know. And I would spend the first week really, really fearful. But then within 2 weeks, now I'm angry. I'm angry. And I'm fighting every day. You call me the N-word, we fighting.
Fighting with girls?
Girls, boys, whoever said it. Whoever called me the N-word, it was on then. And I can remember my mother telling me, you know, I come home and you know, that first, probably the first month of school, I never came home looking the way I went to school. I would go to school with two little ponytails and come home and one of them be out, because you know what? It was done. And I remember my nickname was Frog, because I had really big eyes. And my
was what?
Frog. So they always call me Frog. And so my dad would sit down and talk to me about, now I'm going to tell you, Froggy, you need to not worry about what them people call. And I said, they call me that. They call me a nigger, and I'm not having it. He says, you know you're not that. So why are you even getting caught up with that? He said, you have to know who you are. You have to know who you are. And he would say that all the time. And then my mother would lecture me about that she better not get a call from that school that I was fighting. She better not. And I laugh about it now because, you know what? It wasn't going to happen. When you call me that word, we going to go to the ground. We going to wrestle. It didn't matter if I had panties up or not. We going at it, you know. And so, you know, finally, I can still remember one day when my mother said to me, I better not get a call from you or you're not going to like what happens when you get home. And, you know, going to the bus stop, they had a man named Mr. Jones, and Mr. Jones had a dog. And, you know, we grew up with Mr. Jones' dog, and you knew when you got to Mr. Jones' house, you had to run, because Mr. Jones' dog was going to chase you. If you was on your bicycle, you were going to have to ride fast. If you were walking, you was going to have to run. And we would prep ourselves to run past Mr. Jones' house, so before his dog came out. And I never forget this day I had a fight with a guy named David Gill, and they told me that they were gonna call my mother, so I knew the deal. And I was so upset about the whole situation. I got off the bus and I got my backpack and I'm walking. And then I get to Mr. Jones' house and I know I got to run. So I take a deep breath and I put my backpack on and I start running. And Mr. Jones' dog is behind me barking. And all of a sudden, I just had a moment that they later on, they would say one of them snap moments. You know, I didn't know what it was then. That just was one of them moments that I just came to a conclusion. I was tired of running. I was tired of being a victim, and I just stopped. And I threw my books down, and when Mr. Jones' dogs came, I pulled my fist back, and I punched it for all he was worth, and the poor little dog fell out. And Mr. Jones informed my dad that his hunting dog was never the same after that. That gully demon punched his dog off. And my dad used to breed beagles, so he gave Mr. Jones a beagle puppy. But for me, it was just that moment that I had enough. You know what I mean? And Mr. Jones' dog kind of represented everything that I had been going through for that month of moving from segregation to integration. And I just, you know, I just didn't want to take it anymore.
You said the dog was never the same. It sounds like you were never the same.
I got it when I got home, because now not only did I do the fighting that my parents told me not to do, but I done punched out Mr. Jones' dog, too. You know, that day was not a happy day for me, okay? But that day also was a defining day for me. It's that I came to the conclusion that I was not a victim, okay? I was not what they said I was, and that I began to live life from that day forward about why not me? Why not? Why can't I be the tetherball champion? Why can't I be the song leader for the 4-H club? Why can't I have my own youth in action club? And remembering that helps me in what I do now with Northwest Tap. My goal is definitely to have kids learn dance, but really dance is the hook so that I get them in here and they like something that I can talk to them about life. And my mom used to talk about how you throw out seeds and some seeds, you know, kind of get rooted and other seeds blow away. But even if you just get like maybe even 10% of who comes through these doors rooted into understanding who they are and making a better tomorrow, that makes it so, so good, you know, and successful for me.
That's Melba Aiko, the artistic and program director of Northwest Tap Connection in Seattle's Rainier Valley. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week our theme is The Kids Are All Right. Dr. Sam Blackman often encounters kids during the toughest stretch of their lives. He's a pediatric oncologist, so any kid he meets on the job likely has some big problems. He says when he tells people what he does for a living, they tend to look at him like his dog just died. Childhood cancer is scary, but he says sometimes, the majority of the time, actually, the kids are all right. He tells this story of a case very early in his career when he learned that lesson.
I was on my way out the door, my pager went off, and it was a nurse at a hospital across the street from Children's Hospital in Boston called Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital, which is not a pediatric hospital. And she said, we need you to come over. And I said, you clearly have the wrong person because I'm a pediatric oncologist. You must have wanted somebody else. And she said, no, we really wanted you. And they said, well, we want you to come over to the maternal fetal medicine unit. And I said, all right, let me make this a little bit clearer. I'm a pediatric oncologist, and neither maternals or fetals really fall into my remit. And she said, no, really, you just need to come here. I said, fine. And I went into this radiology suite, and they said, there's your patient. They pointed to like a blob on the screen, and it was an ultrasound image. And I said, all right, tell me what I'm looking at. And they said, there's a baby. And I said, okay. And they said, that bright spot, and they pointed to a bright spot on the outline of this child's spine. They said, that bright spot should not be there. Okay. And I'd been at this now for maybe a year. And there are things that you typically see. You see leukemias and you see children with solid tumors. But, you know, a 35-week fetus was way outside of what I had expected. And I said, well, I guess I got my research to do. So I did what most normal people would do. I went to Google and I said, what do you do about a fetus with a tumor? And Google spit out a bunch of references to papers on fetal spinal cord tumors. And unfortunately, most of them were in Japanese. And so Google Translate, what do you do here? And there was an urgency to this because it was clear from the images that the tumor was invading the spinal canal and pressing on the spinal cord. If this didn't get fixed soon, that this child was going to be at risk from being paralyzed, you know, essentially from the waist down. So we put all this into place, and that Sunday they delivered the baby by cesarean section, and Monday we set this whole plan into motion. The surgical team in the operating room, putting a line in the child's subclavian vein and doing a biopsy of the tumor and getting a pathologist there to come up with a diagnosis off of a very small specimen. And I remember having to do a bone marrow biopsy on a child, and you've got this relatively big needle and this incredibly small baby, and you're trying to suck some bone marrow out of their hip, which is terrifying to do for somebody who's never done it before. And we put all of these things into place, and at the end of the day, we came up with this plan. We presented it to the child's parents. We said, this is what we think the diagnosis is, and this is what we are proposing as a treatment plan. And we'd like your permission to get started. And telling this to people who've just had a baby is a very hard conversation to have. There are so many different things to consider. Most pediatric cancer requires the use of multiple chemotherapy drugs, and chemotherapy drugs in general excel at killing rapidly dividing cells. Newborn babies are all rapidly dividing. I mean, in adults, our rapidly dividing cells are the ones that make our hair and the ones that line our digestive tract from our mouth all the way through our intestines. And that's why when you get chemotherapy as an adult, your hair falls out and you get sick to your stomach and you have diarrhea. And to factor all of that into a newborn child is a daunting task. So the parents consented to this, and we got started, and this little baby got chemotherapy on his very first day of life. And this child, he did well with his first course of therapy, but it was clear that the tumor had compressed his spinal cord a lot. He was in a breech position when he was delivered, and his legs were unbelievably floppy. And my bigger concern beyond just shrinking the tumor was that he was going to have a lifetime of neurological defects to contend with. So we got the child through his first cycle of therapy, and he was able to go home and then come back, and we did a number of additional cycles. And in the end, the tumor completely disappeared. The before and after images are remarkable because the lesion was really sizable before, and it was completely gone afterwards. And of course, the family was thrilled. I was personally thrilled. But as the oncologist, I had done my part. They don't need you so much. And you tend to sort of go your separate ways. You might see the child in follow-up every 3 months or 6 months or once a year or even less. And so it had been about a year or so. And at the time, I was embarking on a fundraiser for the pediatric oncology program where I was in Boston. And in doing so, I told a lot of people what I was trying to do, and I was thinking how I could fundraise creatively. So I had a party at my house. And the parents of this little boy showed up at the party. And I said, "I'm so thrilled to see you. You get to really get close with these families." I said, "How's Henry?" And he said, "He's great." And I said, "Oh, you should have brought him with. I would have loved to have seen him." And they said, "He's here." I said, "Oh, great." I said, "Why don't you wheel him in?" And they said, "Oh." And I turned, and he walked. He was walking in. And I'd never seen him walk before. He just had this radiant smile. I mean, the thing that I think about when I saw him walk in was just that giant grin on his face. Every single step for him was a privilege, and you could tell. It's been 14, 15 years since that happened, and the surge of emotion that I felt then, I feel today, and I'll probably feel it every day for the rest of my life whenever I think about it. It was one of the most joyous moments of my life. And it wasn't for me. It was just this universal joy of a life that was saved, a child that was truly healed. You know, there are times in oncology where you win the battle and you lose the war, right? You shrink the tumor for a while, but it comes back and the patient dies. Or, you know, I subspecialized in pediatric brain tumors, and you would treat children very intensively and they would recover from their cancer, but they might be neurologically devastated. And this was one of those times where I thought, you know, I won the battle, we lost the war, but no, this child, he walked. And it was miraculous. And I say that with the full meaning of the word, invested there. And I've stayed in touch with his family for the past now 10 or almost 15 years. And I've seen Henry. I've seen him walk. I've seen him ride a bike. He plays lacrosse. He runs around. And he's just this brilliant, amazing young man. And when I think back over my career, and people say, you know, in pediatric oncology, it must be a really, really sad area of medicine to work in, I tell them, no. You don't get it. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily know, because cancer in children is terrifying, especially if you're a parent. But the reality is about 70% of children diagnosed with any form of cancer survive. And there's always things to hope for, even in the most dismal diagnosis. There's always hope.
Dr. Sam Blackman is a physician, researcher, and storyteller in Seattle. You're listening to Sound Effect. Today our theme is "The Kids Are All Right." I'm Gabriel Spitzer. There's a debate going on in American higher education about trigger warnings and safe spaces, free speech, and so-called political correctness. In the spring of 2017, the Evergreen State College in Olympia became famous, briefly, in that arena. A discussion about campus equity there had spiraled into a true crisis, with protests, counter-protests, death threats, neo-Nazis, and Tucker Carlson.
Time now for campus craziness, and tonight, the title is not an overstatement, it really is crazy.
The crisis has subsided, but it isn't really over. Enrollment is down, and the college is struggling financially. It's in this environment that one professor, Mike Peros, is teaching a class called "Liberal Education in the College Bubble: Crossing the Political and Cultural Divide." We sent Sound Effect's Posey Gruner to learn more.
Mike Peros' class looks just like any other at this famously progressive liberal arts college. There's a professor in front of the whiteboard, 14 students at long tables, and freely roaming among their legs, a little dog.
At Evergreen, we welcome all people, all viewpoints, and species. That's what we do at Evergreen.
On this day, the class is talking about confirmation bias. The projector shows a simple math problem.
And here's the data.
SAT level probability stuff. This problem was part of a study about how people evaluate controversial data. And here's what's interesting. When the title above the graph says something kind of humdrum, like effectiveness of face cream, people who are better at math are better at solving the problem. Makes sense. But when you take the exact same numbers and put controversial words above them, like climate change, something kind of strange happens. Math skills don't matter.
People with high numeracy are more likely to get it right only if it is consistent with their beliefs.
Once you believe something, it's hard to stop believing
it. They get it wrong if it goes against their beliefs.
That's the big question for this class. How did we get into our bubbles? And how do we get out of them? It's a question that almost promises to make people uncomfortable. But these students know what they signed up for. It said it right there in the course catalog. Students who require ideological safe spaces where particular viewpoints are considered offensive may want to seek a different program. At a progressive campus in 2018, those are fighting words. Then there's the fact that a major text for the class is written by Jonathan Haidt. He's the author of a much-debated 2015 article titled The Coddling of the American Mind. And finally, there's the fact that Mike Peros, the professor of the class, is surrounded by controversy. Here's what happened. During the 2016-17 school year, racial tensions were high at Evergreen. Then, a professor named Brett Weinstein criticized the format of a campus diversity event that invited white students to leave campus. First, he complained on a campus listserv. Then, after protesters targeted him,
he spoke
to the Fox News host Tucker Carlson.
Wow. Professor Brett Weinstein joins us.
After the segment aired, there was a brief and scary time at the college where neo-Nazis came to protest, death threats were called in, and graduation had to be moved off campus because of security concerns. Many students and faculty denounced Weinstein as a racist and demanded he resign. In the middle of all of this, Peros publicly defended Weinstein's right to speak his mind. He says he's the only faculty member who did so. Now, Peros created this course years ago, before the protests. But after the protests, he worried that his class would be protested too. That hasn't happened yet. What has happened is exactly what Peros hoped would happen. His students have started to really listen to people they disagree with. It's part of a three-step process that Peros asked every student in the class to go through. First step, identify a hot-button issue you feel like you know the answer to. Here's student Matt Evans.
I think the liberals would put me in right-wing conservative.
Matt's strongly held belief? We need to build the wall. Matt's classmate, Faith Rasmussen, sits right behind him in class, and far to the left of him on the political spectrum. Faith's strongly held belief was about the importance of vaccinations. Second step, explore how you came to your belief.
So my father at the time was
It's that his dad worked at a fishing company.
Past tense. And he ended up losing his job because they paid too much and they had to downsize people. And then they hired a bunch of undocumented immigrants.
That led to Matt holding what he calls a very strong position on immigration. Then there's Faith. She grew up with parents who were doctors, and she has a lot of respect for modern medicine. So it was upsetting when her sister chose not to vaccinate her niece.
I remember when it happened of me being like, I don't want to hear why you're doing this. Like, you're wrong. You're endangering my niece. You're endangering the people she goes to daycare with. Like, how could you? But I would say, like, how could you? And then, like, not listen to the answer, right? So
third step, talk with someone who believes differently than you do. Because of this class, Faith went to talk with her brother-in-law about why they chose not to vaccinate her niece. She didn't really get very far.
He has much less trust in the scientific industry and the healthcare system than I do.
Faith realized that showing her brother-in-law the data about vaccinations wasn't going to change his mind. Still, Faith says she's glad she had the conversation. Matt, her classmate, went through the same three-step process, and he did change an opinion, his own. Before the class started, Matt really only had one opinion about the wall.
That it needed to be up as soon as possible. And now I think it's a big waste of money.
And how many weeks has it been?
7 weeks.
So what do you make of that?
Crazy.
Professor Peros says that's the kind of self-examination that's really essential to the liberal part of a liberal arts education. Not like liberal and conservative, but like liberalis, to be free. To not be tied to one's own ideas. Because you never know. They might be wrong.
Basically, a lot of the books we're reading sort of shows just how irrational we are. And hopefully the effect is, I know that has an effect on me, is that, wow, you know, I'm not as smart as I think. I don't make decisions always the right way. And that, as I think some of the students have told you, we're almost incapable of self-criticism. We absolutely need other people around us to provide other viewpoints.
As for Faith, she says she's glad she took the class.
I think it's the most relevant class being offered on campus right now, to be completely honest. Like Evergreen is known for being very liberal, very progressive. Some would argue to a fault, right? Like with the stuff that happened a couple years ago. And I think it's really important to explore that and to be able to check ourselves, because I also identify as like a progressive liberal. But you can't just yell at the other people.
That story from Sound Effects' Posey Gruner with Bethany Denton. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and this week our theme is The Kids Are All Right. Anyone who's ever had a young person in their life has probably worried at some point, or every day, that something awful could happen to them. That's what was on Tim Haywood's mind late at night when his youngest daughter went off to Western Washington University.
Does she have enough toothpaste? Does she have enough Brita filters? Because if one Brita filter expires, who knows what's going to happen?
There is a memory that Tim's revisiting more often these days. It's about a trauma, but it's actually helping to quiet the anxiety he has over his daughter. It's from back in 1982 when Tim was a young college freshman at the University of Washington.
The UW has a reputation of being quite a cold place, huge, massive, impersonal institution. You know, 300-person classes, massive campus. I hadn't really given much thought as to how impersonal the place could really be until I was assigned to a cluster in McMahon Hall. It's this massive concrete brutalist structure. It turned out I was assigned to a room with six swimmers and from the University of Washington swim team and Gary. We bonded immediately. I don't know if it was because of our mutual fandom of General Hospital back in the heyday of Luke and Laura. We had a standing appointment every day to watch it together. Or maybe it was because the swimmers were so big and strong that they would just pummel us whenever they felt like it. And after about a quarter there, things hadn't really thawed out too much at the UW. It's a tough nut to crack in terms of making friends. But I really didn't care at that point because Gary was a good friend. I'd made friends with some of the swimmers. We were hanging out. It was fun. During winter quarter, we decided to take a little ski trip. Took off the next morning. It was well below freezing, but it was beautiful, bright day. We could see the mountain range ahead of us, and we were just excited to ski. We got up to the pass, and it was snowing fairly substantially. There was a sign that said snow chains and traction tires required, so we pulled up, pulled off the road. You couldn't really tell where the snow drifts ended and the road started. we got out of the car, started putting our chains on, and we looked out and we thought, you know, we're a little too close to the road. Let's get a little further off. So we drove up about 10 yards, pulled over again. And just as we pulled over, a truck pulled into where we had just been, a little maroon pickup. We start putting our chains on again, and up ahead, we hear this, hey, Gary. Well, it's Gary's aunt and uncle, coincidentally, up ahead of us. They're up there snowshoeing, so we're like, hey, how you doing? Good to see you. You know, enjoy your day. Went back to what we were doing. And at that point, things got weird. I looked up, and there was a school bus getting off the road directly towards us. As the man who had pulled up behind us into our old spot got out of his truck, the bus hit him immediately. He didn't even see it coming. I remember my hand resting on the grill of that bus. It was warm. And I remember looking up at the bus driver's eyes, and I've never seen anyone's face look like that before or since. It was just the worst look I've ever seen in anyone's face in my life. I mean, he had just run into somebody. At that point, it was a dream state. I just remember staring up at the bright blue morning sky, and it was strangely calm, yet I could hear screams everywhere. Because as it turned out, the school bus was filled with kids coming up to go skiing. And then another part of the screaming was from the fiance of the man who had just been hit by the bus and run over. All of a sudden, there's Gary's uncle leaning down over this man's body. And it was a body. He was obviously dead. But he was doing CPR on this man's face. And I remember thinking to myself, that's amazing. The state patrol came, secured the scene, interviewed us, did measurements. You know, as the day wore on and the sun came out, the snow melted to slush, and there was just a big bloody slush ring around our car and the victim, and it was awful. Finally, we got to leave, but we couldn't drive Gary's car. It had been totaled. This bus had completely smashed the back end of it. Fortunately, Gary's uncle and aunt were there to take us back to our dorm, and I remember going back in his car, looking up at Gary's uncle and thinking, you're the bravest person I've ever seen in my life. He still had blood on his face. He had it all over his clothes. But there he is, just driving his car, driving us back. And then in the months that followed, I had such a gamut of emotions about the whole thing. Shouldn't that have been me who died? I mean, we were parked in that spot where the guy was, and we did move forward. I learned that this man who died had several children and a fiance, and I'm like, well, why was I chosen to live, or why was I able to live, and he wasn't? I talked to a lot of people about it. People reached out to me and at school and this big impersonal place that was the University of Washington. Turned out not to be so bad after all. Strangers came up. I don't know how they heard about it, but they'd come up and say, hey, I heard about your accident. That's terrible. Are you doing okay? But the one person I didn't talk to about it was Gary. I guess we were just dudes who aren't used to expressing our emotions. I think it was just too raw to talk to Gary about it. And I'll always regret that because I moved out about, I don't know, 3 weeks later and really never saw him again. If you would have said to me, Tim, you're going to go to college, you're going to be there a couple months, and then you're going to see a horrific accident that almost kills you too, but you're going to be okay, I would have thought, really? Well, that's good, but I wouldn't have believed it. And that's why I know that my daughter's going to be okay too. As much as I worry that she's going to make shady friends. I worry that she'll be like snagged into some sort of evil satanic cult because she's lonely and having a hard time. I worry that she's gonna get disillusioned with school and not want to keep doing it, or I don't know, just all these things just rush through your head, especially around 3 in the morning. Our whole purpose as parents is to raise our kids to be able to live on their own without us. And even though, sure, yeah, I spoiled her a little bit. Okay, I spoiled her a lot. I think she's gonna be okay.
That's sound effect contributor Tim Haywood. Tim says he's still hoping to talk to his former friend Gary about that accident from 3 decades ago. He's reached out to him, but so far has not gotten a response. Today on Sound Effect, our theme is The Kids Are All Right. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. In her early 20s, Ginny McClure got some bad news. It was the kind of news that people tend to be embarrassed to share. Ginny resolved to not be ashamed, to shout it from the rooftops even. Still, there are certain subjects that you don't really want to talk about with certain people, like your parents. For Ginny, that subject was sex. Now, I can imagine a lot of us would prefer not to talk about sex with our parents, but it was complicated for her by the fact that her dad is a gynecologist. So you can imagine what it was like for her when, in 5th grade, her father came to her school to help teach sex ed.
What actually happened when we get to 5th grade is that they split up the girls and the boys, and my friend's mom, who's a nurse, talks to the girls, and my dad talks to the boys, and they bring everyone together, and they talk about STDs and STIs. But my dad, just being a dad, was just like, oh yeah, and you all know my daughter, Ginny, who you go to school with. And just like the tone of the day and then having to be called out like that was mortifying. But there got to be a point. It was May something. I was getting ready to go down to San Diego for my sister's graduation. And I was just kind of uncomfortable. Like every time I sat, it kind of just felt weird. And I got in the shower and I was like, I could just look. I found a very little painful red bump that kind of looked like a pimple. And I just was shocked. And instead of worrying about it or waiting the like 6 hours until I went to San Diego and actually saw my dad, I called him. And I was nervous. I was just like, Dad, this is so weird. And I know it's probably not true, but can you get eczema on your genitals? And he was just like, no. And I was like, cool, great. And he just said, don't be an idiot. Go to the doctor. And I was like, yeah, I was totally going to do that. I'll do it right now.
And how old were you at this time?
I was 24.
Okay.
I was 24. So I just like kind of took the first doctor's appointment I would get, and I spent like the rest of that week like basically what do? So I go to the doctor, just be like, well, this looks like it could be herpetic. I never heard that word before, but I knew what it meant. I just like felt my whole stomach drop to the floor. My mind was racing, like which friend was I gonna call to like talk me through this? Like what was I gonna do? And I didn't call my dad back after that doctor's appointment. I was really, really worried about what he would say. And I'd kind of been dodging his calls. He'd called me a few times. I finally was just like, can't run forever. So I answered his phone call. And I just remember crying and just being like, I got diagnosed with herpes. Like, what do I do? No one's ever going to date me. Like, how am I going to, like, how do I do life? And his response was just so casual and cavalier. I was almost caught off guard. He just was, everyone has herpes. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah, like pretty much everyone has herpes. And that a lot of people carry the antibodies, but they don't transmit it. All this medical stuff that I was just like, what? So it was interesting to read all of this and learn that I wasn't like off on this island out in the middle of nowhere by myself where I was just totally unlovable and undateable. Anyways, and the more I read and the more I researched, I was just like, you know what? This is kind of silly that there should be stigma about this. So, and I didn't really date during this whole time, but I told a lot of people. I told almost everyone I knew. Partly because it felt like when I felt like I had the knowledge of, you know, stigma and all of this, and debunking that, I felt like kind of powerful.
You could be herpes girl.
Exactly. And I was herpes girl. It was a great icebreaker. My icebreaker used to be that my dad is a gynecologist, because I learned very early the responses from that would be hilarious and weird. And now having an icebreaker of like, oh, I have herpes, just like took it to the next level.
So before we go on, did you make a conscious decision to be public or, you know, be out about it?
Yeah, I wanted it to kind of be a thing that people knew about me from the onset so that I didn't ever have to come out about it later into a friendship or a relationship or anything like that. It made me feel more comfortable that people just knew.
And what do you remember it feeling like early on in that, like the first few people that you told?
So the first few people were like my improv team, the people I spent like most of my time with, who I think were like the best people to tell because they didn't like feel sorry for me. They didn't treat it like a tragedy because I told them and they were just like, cool. Like they didn't make it bigger than it should have been. And that also kind of added fuel to my fire in this way of like, well, these people are cool with it. I'm just going to tell everyone.
Then what happened?
I made a appointment to see a gynecologist, like, and it was like a while down the road, a couple months. And at this point, like, I was very comfortable with my diagnosis and everything. So I went into the doctor and I kind of just sat down and I had my little gown and I was just like, so I have herpes, this is the deal. And she was like, okay, great, let's take a look. And she was kind of preparing me for this pelvic exam, which can be kind of stressful. So she was talking to me about anything else that you could talk about besides a pelvic exam. And I think we were talking about double stuffed Oreos. And we're talking about the Oreos and all of a sudden she goes, I don't know how to tell you this, but you don't have herpes. And I was just like, huh, are you sure? I can't believe I said that to a doctor. Are you sure? And she's like, no, I'm sure. And she said, you know, might you have really sensitive skin? And I was like, yeah, but I didn't think that, from what I know, I didn't think that this could be eczema or something. And she goes, well, it's probably not eczema, but my best guess would be that this would be related to some sort of skin sensitivity that you have. She's like, well, your blood test came back positive for herpes antibodies. And pretty much everyone who's ever had sex with anyone has those. After that, I realized that everyone that I had told that I had herpes, I would have to go back, walk back my previous story and tell them that I did not actually have herpes.
So how did that go generally? Like, do people give you high fives or what?
Most people were just like, okay, good for you. I think people were like, why are we still talking about this? We have been talking about it so much, Ginny.
Do you remember telling your dad?
Actually, I didn't tell my dad for a really long time, purely because I forgot. I think it was the first time I had told this story for a class at Second City. And I was telling my dad about my storytelling show, and he goes, well, what are you telling your story about? And I was like, oh, well, when I had herpes, I thought I had herpes and then I didn't actually have herpes. And he's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, did I not tell you? I went to a gynecologist, I don't have herpes. And he was like, oh, okay, great.
And when you got the news from the gynecologist, what were the emotions at that moment?
I was a little sad, isn't the right word, but there was a part of me that I was just like, oh, this is like, I've been spinning this whole narrative about myself that I was really proud and I felt very bold and I didn't get to have that anymore. And after thinking about it some more, I was just like, I can still talk about this and debunk stigma. It just is not going to be about me personally. It kind of makes me feel like I can take more ownership of other stories that maybe aren't so sensationalizing.
Ginny McClure is studying to become a drama teacher. She lives in Tacoma. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestead, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Bethany Denton and Paul Currington of Fresh Ground Stories. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can hear our podcast twice a week in all the podcast places, including Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and your smart speaker. And if you rate and review us, I will owe you big time. We're back next week with our annual Thanksgiving tradition, a collection of our favorite music stories from the past year. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.